Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to Gilbert and Tobin for the use of this facility. It's the first occasion on which we've been here, so many thanks for that. Paul Kelly makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, this time on the occasion of the publication this week of his book, The March of the Patriots, by Melbourne MUP, or Melbourne University Press. I'll introduce Paul Kelly very briefly. He's well known to all of you. He's the editor-at-large of The Australian, was previously editor-in-chief of The Australian, and he writes on Australian politics, public policy and international affairs. Paul Kelly has covered Australian governments from Gough Whitlam to Kevin Rudd, and he spent two decades in the Canberra Press Gallery. And he's also, of course, a regular commentator on the ABC television program Insiders on ABC One every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. And Paul Kelly is the author of six books: The Unmaking of Gough, The Hawke Ascendancy, The End of Certainty, November 1975, Paradise Divided, and 100 Years, The Australian Story, and now The March of the Patriots, which is the topic for tonight's discussion. Paul Kelly, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard. It's a great pleasure for me to be at the Sydney Institute. I thank Gerard Henderson for the invitation to come along tonight. I also congratulate Gerard and Anne Henderson on the 20th anniversary of the Sydney Institute. In this time, it's made a real, genuine difference to our intellectual life. And the range and diversity of speakers that have appeared at the Institute over many years is striking. I would also like to acknowledge Gerard and Anne for their individual contributions as writers addressing so many aspects of Australia's political and cultural life. In particular, I mentioned Gerard's columns in the Fairfax Media, which for many years have offered a sharp insight and analysis of political and historical trends. The March of Patriots is the story of Paul Keating and John Howard as Prime Ministers. It's also about what I call the struggle for modern Australia. The foundations of this book are that political leadership matters and that leaders can change a country. This is a book more about government than politics, though of course the two are forever intertwined. It's about policy, institutional reform, and Australia's national direction, and it deals with economic, social, and foreign policy. I've tried to get inside the prime ministerial operations of both Keating and Howard, and I guess I've tried to get inside their heads, looking at how they governed, how they ran the economy, went to war, and pursued their aspirations. And of course it deals with not just their achievements, but also their failures. The book took about 6 years to research and write. In truth, however, it's more like 40 years in the making. I first met Paul Keating in 1971 when he was an incredibly youthful young member of the Labor Caucus, having been elected at the 1969 election, and I first met John Howard in 1974 after he was elected to the National Parliament at the May 1974 election. And I think it's fair to say that I've lived through their tribulations, triumphs and tears ever since. I respect them both for the tremendously long commitment they made to Australian public life. For me, although they're very different people, Keating and Howard go together. They came from not dissimilar parts of Sydney, They were children of the 1950s and 60s. They were children of the Menzingen age, raised in not just the same generation, but families of very similar structures. Fathers involved in small business, mothers dedicated to the household. They were both raised in the age of white Australia, full employment and the convenience of male dominance, in households that believed in Christian values, personal responsibility and progress through hard work. Both came from political families, and this is where they were divided, Labor and Liberal. They were tribalised early, and as young adolescents, both were committed to politics, to the Labor and Liberal parties respectively. Neither excelled at school or was particularly brilliant or clever, yet both were driven, ambitious, with a determination to learn and adapt. That both men leapt from the Sydney suburbs to the Prime Ministership in the space of 25 or 30 years testifies to Australia's remarkable democracy. Divided by tribe, personal temperament and a number of political values, they were united by generation, events and common challenges. Keating and Howard go together in their career progress, in their rivalry and in their undeclared agreements. They ran the Australian Treasury from 1977 to 1991 unbroken. First Howard, then Keating, a total of 14 years. And after that, they ran the Prime Ministership from 1991 to 2007 unbroken. First Keating, then Howard, a total of 16 years. As party leaders, Keating and Howard were completely dominant in their parties. Labor was Keating, Liberal was Howard, and we saw virtually the total capitulation of party identity to their aspirations and will to power. Their fingerprints, their branding, their beliefs run all over modern Australia, and that's really what the book is about. Where they agreed, their ideas became entrenched. An open economy, tariff abolition, termination of centralised wage fixation, a nexus with China, integration of the US alliance and Asian engagement, Medicare, and a highly progressive income redistribution. Where they disagreed, the unresolved legacy was left to Kevin Rudd. Aboriginal reconciliation, the Republic, trade union powers, the history wars, and the balance between social libertarianism and social conservatism. For me, Keating and Howard were authentics. Good company, fierce advocates, remarkably open about their aspirations and what they were trying to do. While ruthless pragmatists, I think to a very considerable extent, they were conviction politicians, and in the end, there's a strong argument that both died for their convictions. They constituted a political brand and style which is probably gone forever. Politics today is more based on marketing. It's a technocratic style dominated very much by the 24-hour media cycle, a cycle that Keating, for one, detested. So the book is about two men, but it's more than just two men. It's about the ideas that have shaped and driven modern Australia. I want to say something about how the book is framed. In my view, we have a system in this country best described as prime ministerial government in order to label the system. It is not the system of Westminster in London. It is not the presidential system of Washington. It is a uniquely Australian brand of prime ministerial government, which allows the Prime Minister, if he chooses, to put his stamp on the country. And both Keating and Howard did this, just as I think Kevin Rudd also aspires to do it. The book attempts to coolly evaluate both men on merit and performance. I distrust sweeping criticisms of politicians as a class. I have no time for armchair moralists who condemn politicians as immoral while refusing to evaluate the real-world political choices that leaders face. This book is written from an inside perspective. It looks at the actual choices Keating and Howard faced. For me, the modern age of Australian politics begins in 1983 with Bob Hawke's election. While the book is alert to the failings of both Keating and Howard, I do argue that Australia's progress since 1983 has been very substantial under Hawke, Keating and Howard as Prime Ministers, although the book, of course, focuses on Keating and Howard. It accepts neither the Labor nor Liberal view of history. To me, acceptance of either view for a contemporary analyst is a caricature and always makes for bad history. I operate on the principle there's no monopoly on good policy or political virtue. I think Australian journalism, political journalism I'm talking about, is focused too much on politics and not enough on government. It's not all that hard to write about politics. It's much more difficult to write about government, to analyse and assess governments, working out how they operate, what sort of policies they're delivering, and assess the actual performance of government and evaluate public policy. So this book is unmistakably about government, and for this reason, I think and I hope that you will find considerable material in the book that you weren't aware of before. My title is The March of Patriots for two reasons. The most obvious reason and the less significant reason is that Keating and Howard were both patriots in their projection of a deeper sense of national identity, although they had different views and perspectives on that. Paul Keating said 4 weeks after becoming Prime Minister that he wanted to remake Australia. He said that he believed that the new Australia could be reborn in the 1990s. He was talking about faith, and he used the word faith, and he was talking about the need to instill a greater sense of confidence and self-esteem in Australia. Keating had a profound conviction that Australia was too much a derivative society and too dependent on our British heritage. He saw this as a weakness. He said at one point, the economic imperative and the cultural imperative can't be separated. And what he aspired to do, which is a most unusual aspiration for a Prime Minister, was to alter this sense of the Australian spirit, alter this sense of Australian identity. And he believed that only by kindling a deeper sense of national self-confidence could Australia address issues such as Aboriginal reconciliation, economic reform, and a genuinely independent foreign policy. This was an extremely contentious position, but it was one that Keating held with an absolute passion. And of course, it is very much the essence of patriotism. And John Howard, when he was Prime Minister, more, I think, than any previous Liberal leader or Liberal Prime Minister, presented himself as a strong Australian nationalist. And he appropriated a lot of the symbols of nationalism, Anzac, the Bush ethos, the battler's image, the sporting icon, the idea of mateship. And I think Labor was quite slow to work out what Howard was doing, but Howard quite ruthlessly went out and took these symbols and associated them with him, his image, and his government. And this was a very strong act of patriotism and nationalism, which of course he did for self-interested reasons, but also factors which related to his own sense of self and his own view of the prime ministership. So both Keating and Howard had this very powerful sense of patriotism. In Howard's sense, also a very strong sense of nationalism. But the more substantial reason for the title is my unifying argument that in this period, a distinctively Australian policy model was being devised for success in the globalised age. The Keating-Howard model was not American, it was not Asian, it was not European. It was a distinctively Australian policy response that reflected our culture and our characteristics as a people. It was designed to make Australia a successful society in a more challenging globalised age. And one example, the proof of this, is the situation of the Australian economy in 2008 at the onset of the global financial crisis. Our economic model was not the model of America, it was not the model of Britain, it was not the model of Europe or Asia. This is quite clear now. It's been demonstrated and it's been proved by the performance of the Australian economy in the teeth of this global downturn. It was a particularly Australian model, and it was a model fashioned in particular by Keating and Howard. I think that we've had quite a substantial debate in this country about the trade-off between economic growth and egalitarianism. And there's no ideal balance here, but I think Australia has struck a balance of considerable merit, where we've avoided the grossly inadequate social safety net of the United States, but also avoided Europe's stultifying regulation and government intervention. I think Australia has done well in getting this balance between entrepreneurship and egalitarianism. In every aspect of policy, the Australian model has been distinct: economic, social, and foreign policy. Let me say a little bit about Keating and Howard as ideological leaders of their parties. I think they both aspired to renovate the beliefs of their parties and devise new governing strategies for new circumstances. I say in the book that Keating tried to find a new light on the hill for Labor. He knew the old Labor ideas were fading, and he attempted to create a new light on the hill for Labour belief around the ideas of a market economy, Asian engagement, the Republic, social inclusion, and Aboriginal reconciliation. And this was what Keating called his big picture. While his light on the hill was extinguished with the 1996 election defeat, Keating argues that these ideas will endure and that these ideas sooner or later have to be addressed by the country, and therefore his new light on the hill will be vindicated in coming years. I think the tragedy for Keating as Prime Minister was that the nature of politics moved beyond him. Keating hated the idea of the 24-hour media cycle. He detested the advice he got from Labor Party headquarters about having to get out on the radio and the media each morning as part of the 24-hour media cycle. He was very resistant to the rising demands of political spin. He was more a political strategist, and I think that you could see this quite clearly in his performance during the 1993-1996 term, when I think he failed to devise an effective political strategy to sustain his policies. I argue that Howard is the most important Liberal Prime Minister since Menzies, and I think he remains to a considerable extent poorly understood and poorly analysed. The Liberal Party has always been a vehicle for leadership, and every successful Liberal leader reinterprets the party's philosophy. I think Howard came to office in 1996 without any master plan. He told me during the 1996 election campaign, "In previous elections we've had master plans for government, The only difficulty was we forgot to win the election. My focus is to win the election. But there's no doubt that while that was his attitude when he first came into office, there's no doubt where he finished. The book argues that Howard stood for four broad ideas: economic liberalism and reform, social conservatism, cultural traditionalism, and national security vigilance. I think Howard is a very ordinary man and a quite complex political leader, and I don't believe that Howard can be understood relying on a one-dimensional or single framework. I think you need a multi-dimensional framework to understand Howard, because he was a conservative on a number of issues, but he was a radical on a number of issues as well, and of course he had a very strong sense of political pragmatism. As an economic liberal, he spearheaded the GST and tax reform, deregulated the labour market and propounded work choices, championed the job network and Telstra privatisation. This was a significant change agenda, in many ways a radical change agenda. As a social conservative, he upheld family values, promoted huge family support off the budget, but took the ideas of personal responsibility, greater personal responsibility, and mutual obligation, and promoted these ideas and tried to enshrine policies around those ideas, and those ideas challenged the prevailing framework of social progressivism. I think as a cultural traditionalist, Howard championed the idea of nation, border protection, national sovereignty, the Anzac ethos, the Western canon in curriculum, Christian values, and Australia's British heritage. He believed the culture war was real, although his performance in fighting the culture war wasn't all that effective. As an agent of national security vigilance, Howard pioneered the idea of Australia as a leader in our region and as a follower in the world outside the region. We were a leader in our immediate region, in the case of intervention in East Timor, in the case of the Iraq and Afghanistan commitments outside our region, we were a follower, joining coalitions led by the United States. I might finish up with a few observations about the comments made by the Prime Minister this week when he launched the book. Mr. Rudd was very complimentary about the book, but he did make two criticisms which go to the heart of some of the issues of contemporary debate. The book argues that Australia has never had a neoliberal government, that neither the Keating government nor the Howard government was a neoliberal government. And it asserts that the closest Australia ever got to neoliberalism was in 1993 with John Hewson's Fight Back agenda. And I've called the chapter on the 1993 election campaign, which describes Hewson's defeat, I've called that chapter The Death of Neoliberalism. I believe that Howard then constructed an alternative strategy. The book argues that Howard in office never aspired to significantly cut the size of government. He kept Medicare and the social safety net, gave huge budget support to families, spent generously, was cautious, work choices aside, about market forces, and in relation to financial regulation, John Howard and Peter Costello were committed to a very strong regulatory regime and totally dismissed any sense of let-it-rip neoliberalism. In short, Howard, to my point of view, shunned the neoliberal agenda, and having not promised this agenda, it's unsurprising that he did not achieve it. The second proposition of the Prime Minister took issue with was the book's argument that Australia's contemporary economic success was a Liberal-Labor shared achievement. My argument is that Labor's contribution from 1983 to 1996 was more dynamic and substantial. It involved float of the dollar, financial deregulation, tariff reductions, competition policy, enterprise bargaining, privatisation, and the move towards central bank targeting, a very substantial agenda. The Howard government's contribution from 1996 to 2007 I see as important and path-breaking in changing conservative ideology. Howard was open about the fact that he was building on Labor's reform agenda, yet wanting to put the Liberal Party stamp on Australia's economic progress. The key coalition initiatives were the fiscal consolidation, the public debt abolition, the creation of an independent central bank. The former governor, Ian McFarlane, said to me the bank's international standing only arrived in 1996 with formal independence. Howard was committed to concerted labour market deregulation, further privatisation, and the GST-led tax reform. The book argues this constituted a long-run Howard-Costello model to deliver sustained economic growth. The Prime Minister's argument in rejecting these two propositions in the book is that the Liberal Party has always had a very strong strand of neoliberal market fundamentalism, and in relation to the second point, he sees Australia's economic modernisation as essentially being a Labor Party project rather than a shared Labor-Liberal project. In the end, Keating and Howard were both rejected by the people. They were political warriors who went to the bitter end. Neither had the popularity of Bob Hawke or the political command of Menzies. Both generated a lot of division and polarisation precisely because they were such tribal warriors. Ultimately, however, I argue that Keating and Howard left a big footprint on the nation, a legacy that's impressive, contradictory, and incomplete. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Paul. And I also say once again thanks to Gilbert and Tobit for the use of this great facility. Thanks also to Andrew Hawkins, who's representing MUP Edina, who helped to set this up, and Janet Grundy, bespoke bookseller to the Sydney Institute, has got some copies of the March of Patriots, and I'm sure Paul Kelly would be happy to sign them after. And so we come to question and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, and maybe a little bit before. Thanks for a fine analysis. I suppose if there were, if you look at the Liberal Party and at the Labor Party, there might be a few people, including the men themselves, who might think that on the cover of your book there might also be Bob Hawke and Peter Costello. So how do you think they fit into the narrative that you've told today? I mean, you have included them, but you've focused on Keating and Howard instead.
I say in the introduction, there's an introduction which attempts to put the Keating and Howard prime ministerships into context. I say in the introduction that I think there have been two great Labor prime ministers, John Curtin and Bob Hawke, essentially because they define two very important eras. Curtin, the 1940s, with the struggle during World War II and the foundations of post-war reconstruction, which stretched for a very long period of time, and Bob Hawke in the 1980s, in terms of modernising the Australian economy. So I see Keating and Howard following on from the Hawke government, where, of course, Keating played such an important role as Treasurer. So I see the Keating and Howard prime ministerships building on Hawke's shoulders, and I'm quite careful at various stages of the book to ensure that the foundations and achievements of the Hawke government are set out where they're particularly important. When it comes to Peter Costello, I argue in the first Howard government chapter, that John Howard came into office with a very fixed idea, and that is that he was going to dominate the government. He came into office with the view that this would not be a Howard Fisher government, and it would not be a Howard Costello government, it would be a Howard government. I mean, that was his view. Now, he was very fortunate in having Peter Costello as Treasurer. And I quote Maxwell Wilton, the former head of the Prime Minister's Department, who sat in the Cabinet room watching Howard and Costello, and Moore Wilton says that he believed that in a policy sense they worked very effectively together. And I think this is true. I think that the Howard-Costello relationship, while it was never close in a personal sense and there was always a degree of tension, in a policy sense, it was a very constructive collaboration. I also quote Arthur Sinodinos in the book, Howard's former chief of staff, saying that he felt whenever he was in the same room with Howard and Peter Costello, there was a tension. He felt a tension there. I think that Costello's achievements as a long-term treasurer are very important. I don't believe he had anything like Keating's appetite for economic reform. And I think that while there are a lot of parallels drawn between Keating's treasurer and Costello's treasurer, I think the differences are quite significant. Costello was very careful and cautious as treasurer. But what Howard and Costello did, I argue, was they set up an economic model. And their three key ideas were the fiscal consolidation, the independent central bank, and labour market deregulation. They cherished these three ideas for their entire 11 years. And to a certain extent, they paid a price for those ideas. But I think these ideas, shared by both Howard and Costello, were fundamental to the long-run growth cycle that we saw.
Paul, I find it fascinating because to go to your next volume and Kevin Rudd after his comments yesterday, to what extent is Kevin Rudd at the moment living off spin? And to what extent is he going to dismantle what you've just described as the reason for Australia's outstanding success through this economic downturn? Or is it simply that he's finding his way, and can you tell us what he believes when he sets his, you know, his print on the nation?
Well, they're the critical questions, and there are no easy answers to those questions. I think that it's important to bear in mind that often it takes prime ministers a while.